celebrate the 88th year of the founding of AA in Akron, Ohio, with this 1988 version of Joe and Charlie, brought to you by the Big Book, LivingAlive.com.
This is probably the first great warning in the Big Book. This thing that we get from the fellowship is extremely important.
That's right.
And it's very powerful. But that alone is not enough. You know, there's a difference between being sober and recovering from the disease of alcoholism. It isn't hard to get sober. You go knock the hell out of a cop, and I'll guarantee you, you're going to sober up pretty fast. The real deal is, how do you learn to live and be happy so you can stay sober? Now, the fellowship will support us long enough to kind of get our heads screwed on straight. And then we can begin to investigate what really has taken place. And we can begin to see that there is a common solution running through this whole thing, which we're going to see in a little bit, turns out to be the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through that, we actually change and become different people. So real recovery depends on two things. Not only the power of the fellowship, but also the power of the common solution. And I think the day that Joe and I really realized this is when we did the first one of these in a more or less formal setting when we went to Lawton, Oklahoma back in 1977. Then this guy asked us to come out and do this in a group setting. And just prior to going out there, I'd had some trouble with my ticker, and we wasn't sure we were going to get to go. And I remember Joe calling me, and he said, "Charlie, what do you think? You think we're going to be able to go to Lawton?" And I said, "Well, Joe, we need to. You know, we have committed ourselves, and some way we need to go." He said, "Well, why don't I bring my car?" And he said, "I'll do the driving, and you can rest all the way out and all the way back." And I said, "Fine, that's great." Now, Joe drives from his home in Little Rock, Arkansas, to where I live in Maysville, Arkansas, which is 225 miles. He picks me up, and then we start down the road from my place to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, you can tell by looking at us that we're people who normally would not mix. You know, there is a little difference in us. He's bald-headed, and I'm not. I'm getting there, though. Now, the third guy that had sat in with us from the very beginning, the one we like to say we practice on for several years, was a guy named Tony. And Tony's last name is Vargas. And he wanted to go out there with us, and he lives out in Tulsa. And we said, "You meet us in the Camelot Hotel parking lot, and we'll pick you up, and we'll all go out there together." So we meet Tony in Tulsa. Tony gets in the car, and we start tooling it down the Turner Turnpike from Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Oklahoma City. Now, the black guy's driving. The Mexican is riding shotgun, and the honky's laying in the back seat, sound asleep, see? And we get out to Lawton, Oklahoma, and we're doing this very page, and I looked on the front row, and the whole front row was filled with Indians from the Anadarko Indian Reservation. And that's the day we really realized what this thing is talking about. Later on, we had one of the greatest happenings that's ever been brought about in our life. We were in South Dakota, and we were doing the Big Book study, and we did this page, and I just told the little story I just told. And a guy in the back of the room jumped up and he said, yeah. He said, "By God, my name is Joe, and I'm one of them damned Indians that was sitting on the front row." And he said, "I've been sober ever since." See?
Sober 13 years.
So we are people who normally would not mix with each other. But there does exist among us a fellowship which is indescribably wonderful. And it is so powerful. And it is so great. And it is so much more than we've ever had before that if we aren't careful, we'll begin to think that's all there is to it. And all we'll do is go to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, doing nothing about the common solution. And when we do that, we're running around with a bad case of untreated alcoholism. The fellowship alone will not bring about recovery from our disease. There are some things we'll find it necessary to do. Now, the next half of this chapter tells us why that is true. The next half of this chapter will talk about people like us. It will describe us and then tell us why. We're going to have that power greater than human power. Let's go over for just a few moments to page 20. How many times people have said to us, "I can take it or leave it alone, why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fella can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again." Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. Now, he's going to describe for us two types of drinkers that these expressions would refer to. He said, moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Remember that normal social drinker? That one that has one, two, or three drinks, get a slightly tipsy, out of control, nauseous feeling, and it's not a big deal for them at all. If any of these observations would take place in their life, like the doctor told him, if he continues to drink, he'll die. Or if the wife says, I believe we're going to have to get a divorce if you continue to drink. Well, they just stop drinking. You see, they do not have an obsession of the mind. They do not have the physical allergy. Alcohol is no great big deal for them. Moderate social drinkers have little trouble in giving up alcohol entirely. Then he talks about a certain type of hard drinker. These expressions would refer to the hard drinker also. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. Now, the hard drinker can stop drinking entirely on his own, or the hard drinker can even learn to moderate his drinking. And he can learn how to drink like a social drinker drinks. He is not an alcoholic. He drinks much like you and I. But if a sufficiently strong reason presents itself to him, he'll either stop entirely or he'll moderate his drinking, one of the two. You and I see him all the time. He's the guy that said, when I was in the service, I was an alcoholic also. But when I got out of the service, I got married and I just quit drinking, and I don't see why the hell you can't either. He is not alcoholic. He drinks like us, but he does not have the disease of alcoholism. Now, but what about the real alcoholic? Now, those observations we read will not refer to the real alcoholic. He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Now, here's a fellow who's been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I think every one of us is a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, we live one way sober, but let us start drinking and we live an entirely different way while we're drinking. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. You know, we don't get mildly intoxicated. Most of us get drunker than hell when we start. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world. Yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tired at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. Remember, Bill blew the whole deal. He had a drink just before, the day before they were to successfully consummate the deal, and he blew the whole thing. He's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. Most of us are fairly intelligent people. Most of us can do about anything we want to do. But when it comes to alcohol, we've got a little problem there. In that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls a structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. He's the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet early next morning, he searches madly for the bottle he displaced the night before. God, how many times have I gone out to that old pickup, looked under the seat, and it wasn't there. And I know, where the hell did I put it? God, you got to have a drink. And you just go crazy trying to find that damn bottle you put somewhere the night before. If he could afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. I sold a chicken farm some years ago, and it had 40 acres on it. And the guy that bought it, every once in a while I see him, and sometimes he'll wave at me and he'll say, hey, Charlie, we found another one. God, I don't know how many bottles of vodka he's found, half empty, spread around that 40 acres, still keeps finding. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. They had a little problem those days with dual addiction. They called it high-powered sedatives. Today we call it marijuana and amphetamines and cocaine. We have a friend in North Carolina that calls it tablets. He said he was duly addicted to whiskey and tablets. So damn near killed him, too. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative which to taper off that he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. Yeah, I think every one of us can find ourselves in that description of alcoholics. Maybe we didn't do all of it. But if we're alcoholic, certainly we did part of that. Last paragraph, page 22. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We're equally positive once he takes any alcohol, whatever into his system, something happens, both in a bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Now, these observations, these things we've been talking about, would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. It's important that you and I understand the allergy to alcohol. I think it's important we understand that in order to accept the fact we can't drink. But the fact that we're allergic to alcohol is really beside the point. None of those things that happen to us when we're drinking could happen to us if we didn't take the first drink. Now, just before we take the first drink, we're stone cold sober. So therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than in the body. You see, my allergy can't get me drunk if I don't take the first drink. All action is born in thought. I can't take the first drink unless my mind tells me it's okay to take it. So the real problem is right up here in my head. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he'll offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes the excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he'll laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. You know, strange as it seems, once in a while, we alcoholics will tell the truth. Not too often, but sometimes. I had a lady the other day who's in Al-Anon, and her husband is still drinking. And she said, "Charlie, all he does is lie, lie, lie." She said, "How can you tell when one of you guys are lying?" I said, "Honey, watch him very closely. And if his lips are moving, he's probably lying too." And then I said, "Do you want me to tell you how to keep him from lying to you?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, would you do that?" And I said, "Sure." I said, "Quit asking him them damn stupid questions." He won't lie to you unless you corner him. You ask him where he was, hell, he can't do nothing but lie. Who are you with? The truth, strange to say, is usually he has no more idea why he took the first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. You know, the practicing alcoholic is just as confused about his alcoholism as anybody else is. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they're down for the count. You know, the great obsession of every alcoholic is someday, somehow, I'm going to learn to drink this stuff and have fun, like I did when I first started. Or I'm going to learn how to drink this stuff without getting drunk like other people do. And we believe we can do that. An obsession is an idea that is so strong that it overcomes all ideas to the contrary and makes you believe a lie. The practicing alcoholic really believes that somehow we're going to learn how to drink this stuff. Page 24, squiggly writing. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. You know, we can't remember what alcohol does to us. And if you can't remember what it does to you, then you don't see anything wrong with drinking it. Willpower is non-existent. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd it in the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
If you enjoyed this episode of Joe and Charlie from Akron in 1988 and would like to hear other versions, different seminars from different years, please visit our website, BigBookLivingLive.com.